two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
JVD Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. There's been a lot of talk about DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. We also been hearing a lot of conversation about restricting what sort of things can be talked about in schools, especially as it pertains to ethnicity and gender. There's been in the works for a while a lot of book bannings. And so this is a pretty contentious moment for many communities of color, people who believe in social justice, folks who are trying to bring about a better tomorrow. There's been, as they call, a backlash against that sort of progress. And I wanted to go to one of the key roots that, and hopefully we can get some insight as to how they navigated that situation and how they're navigating it now. Our guest is an author. He's a professor. His name is Nolan L. Cabrera. And let me just give you a little bit of background on him. He is a nationally recognized scholar specializing in racism, anti-racism, whiteness, and ethnic studies within higher education. He serves as a full professor in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona. Dr. Cabrera was the sole academic featured in the MTV documentary White People, and served as an expert witness in the landmark Tucson Unified Mexican-American Studies case. And that is why we wanted to have him on. He has a new book out. It is called Banned, The Fight for Mexican-American Studies in the Streets and in the Court. So welcome to the show. And I think in the minds of many, we forgot that Arizona was ground zero. Even as we're talking, I can't even remember the law that they passed. But what I do remember is that they went full throttle on Mexican-American studies and banned it and did all kind of crazy stuff. And then it disappeared, you know, which is also kind of indicative of, sadly, how we kind of see and don't see certain folks.
Absolutely.
You know, so people acting like what's happening now is brand new. Like, I can't believe they're banning books. And do you know they're banning ethnic studies? And it's like, you know, this happened a few, it seems like it's even further, maybe almost 10 years ago in Arizona.
More than that.
More,
it was 2010.
Yeah, 2010. So we almost forgot what happened in Arizona. And so, you know, as the song says, by the time we get to Arizona, let's talk a little bit about this. Can you walk us back to this landmark case?
Of course. So for the longest time, there were persistent, I know this is going to come as a complete shock, there were persistent racial inequities in Tucson Unified School District, where white students were massively outperforming their Latino counterparts, even though we're in a 65-70% Latino district. Mm-hmm. And actually, the it was really strange because a lot of folks started organizing in the way that, you know, sort of reminiscent of the 1960s and saying we should have ethnic studies that represent our students. And their argument was a little different. They were like, you literally can't be doing any worse than you're already doing. And this hurts me to say it, but I'm going to say one good thing about the Bush second administration, that they had No Child Left Behind, which is a horrible piece of legislation. So, I mean, don't get it twisted. I don't want people saying, you know, Dr. C is saying, no child left behind. But they did have a requirement to track students and to have good data on students. And when that happened in the early 2000s, it was really clear, like, there were massive inequities in the district. And folks said, look, why not try Mexican-American studies? You know, we're here 50 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border. Give it a shot. And so you had folks over the course of several years just developing and cultivating this curriculum. And by the time that it reached national status, it was the most fully formed, most complete K-12 ethnic studies program in the entire country. And then
it went from K to 12.
Yeah, well, it was mostly in the high schools. There were some sprinklings, but it was mostly dedicated in the high schools, and it was the most, according to Christine Slater, it was the most complete one in the country at the time. And then when I ran the statistics on it, it was also one of the most effective ones in the country. But I'll pause on that for a second. But what happened was that the state's superintendent of public instruction, Tom Horn, he got it in his head that Mexican American studies was teaching kids to be disrespectful, to hate white people, to hate Western culture, to do all these different things. And he made it his mission to create law that would allow him to outlaw the program.
Right. I remember that guy. So let me ask you this.
Sure.
What we're seeing now happened then, back in 2010.
Exactly.
Yes, almost sir. Like this was a script, and that's why I wanted to it have is. You on. Before you move on, I want to ask, what did you attribute to the discrepancies? What was caused? Yeah, was it? I think in the minds of many people, we think it's maybe if they learn to speak English, then they would be. That's the usual go-to.
Yeah, of course,
there was a little bit more to it.
Absolutely. So actually, there's a great quote that I use from a professor at San Francisco State, Jeff Duncan Andrade,
where he said, "Jeff. We know Jeff very well."
And so I want to give credit where credit is due.
Yeah.
Where he said, in my entire years of teaching, I have met no students who have an adverse relationship to learning, but I've met many who have an adverse relationship to school. That distinction right there was everything for me, because I mean, when these kids are told, if you would just, lose the accent, if you would just, get away from these troublemakers, and they're only going to drag you down. And no, those are my homies. Like, you can't, those are the people who've got my back in the community. You know, when you're told that your community is garbage and that success, the only way to be successful is getting out, that psychologically hits you. And then also it's sort of like, why would you, there's a certain rationality to it too, with these students. Doing schoolwork can be hard. It's taxing. It's difficult. And if you don't really have a sense of why am I doing this, it's like, why would you put yourself through that? So much of our curriculum, especially the more and more that it becomes standardized, which that's No Child Left Behind's legacy right there.
Right.
It makes you memorize stuff like you're prepping for Jeopardy. And
right.
Tippecanoe and Tyler too. Like, okay, it's a slang. I have that piece of information in my head. It has no germane relevance in my life.
Right.
And so again, that's the antagonistic relationship, and then it gets even deeper when you have, you have some teachers who literally still abide by the idea of, this is America for Americans. If you like Mexico, go back type thing. So you have all these different competing forces. And then also we have to be really honest about it, that the way that property taxes are structured, you have the way that they fund schools, you have the most in need communities that are the most under-resourced because the property tax revenue is so low, relatively speaking.
Right.
And so you have the opportunity hoarding on the white north side of town, and you have the lack of opportunity and structured in there. And so if you're like a teacher coming out of the University of Arizona, are you going to, for some high-minded social justice purpose, are you going to go down to the South Side where you're going to be underpaid, blamed for everything, taxed, and have a really rigid curriculum? Or are you going to go to the North Side of town where you can experiment and have a better pay and do all this stuff? So it's all these different things are embedded in there that lead to those structured inequities.
We're talking with Dr. Nolan Cabrera. He's the author of a book called Banned. Let's go back to where we left off.
Sure.
Was it Thornhill? Is that the guy who was coming after everything?
It was
Tom Horn. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's talk.
By the way, here's a funny part about that cat. He keeps telling these kids, Mexican American kids, that they're being un-American. He's a Canadian immigrant.
Oh, so he's one of those Ted Cruz type people.
Yeah, exactly. No, he comes at it like that. I'm like, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Like, just the cognitive dissonance there is immense.
Well, it's kind of funny, but it's sad because you see a lot of people who do come from a certain amount of, I hate to use that word privilege because it's often overused, but they come from high-end backgrounds, and they walk in to this country and they immediately latch on to racist tropes. So, I see a lot of folks that come from different places and they automatically have an anti-blackness to them. And they've got it in their head that the reason why black folks in America aren't able to make it is because they don't apply themselves. I'm quick to remind them, you're the one that left because you couldn't make it in your own country since we want to go there. I've been here, but you obviously couldn't make it wherever you're from. And people go nuts when you say that to them. It's like, you left. But nevertheless, they buy into that. And as you pointed out, that trickles down also to our Mexican brothers and sisters as well, these
Yes,
tropes.
it does.
I want to come back to him because it seems like whatever he was doing becomes a blueprint in terms of rhetoric. This whole thing about ethnic studies, in this case, Mexican American studies, is somehow teaching people to hate America, to hate white folks. And we saw that take off back then. I remember it spread quickly over to a Mexican American school in Los Angeles. If you remember, there was a school, and that was the whole impetus. Like, we need to dismantle the school because they are un-American. So this un-American trope, when people are learning about themselves, let's go a little bit deeper into this. How did this play out? How did you all navigate that? What was the type of conversations that we can maybe learn from today?
Absolutely. So, what was difficult is that it wasn't just rhetoric, it was also state law that he eventually got passed,
Right.
right? And that one, it outlawed, I want to make sure I get this right. So it outlawed classes, and it didn't have to be like throughout the district. It just had to be one class that was reported to him as state superintendent. You're not allowed to promote the overthrow of the US government, promote resentment towards a race or class of people, are designed primarily for peoples of a particular ethnic group, or advocate ethnic solidarity instead of treatment of peoples as individuals. Now, that's a lot of political rhetoric, but it doesn't have a lot of legal meaning. Like, how do you know that a class is designed for a specific racial ethnic group, right? Like,
Right.
on the north side of town, you got white kids, 95% white class taking AP European history. That's just coincidence, right?
Right.
When white folks cluster, it's coincidental, it's happenstance. When brown kids do it, they're self-segregating, right?
Right.
And so Tom Horn was able to withhold 10% of the state funding on a monthly basis, which on an annual level was about $15 million. And that put extreme pressure on a broke district to make sure that they complied with his law and eliminated Mexican American studies. Because as he said publicly, partial compliance was not acceptable. And we need to be clear about this because that's part of what one of the really core lessons that we have right now is that the people who are doing these attacks, they're not saying, oh, hey, I was reviewing your curriculum and I really find this one piece objectionable. If you could, modify it, that'd be really nice. It's no, your approach to education is toxic and horrible and it needs to be eliminated. And that's what the liberals in the city of Tucson didn't quite understand was that because we always got this patronizing sort of advice, like, well, just comply with state law and just comply with state law and everything's going to be okay. It doesn't work like that. As soon as you capitulate to that, then it's going to be that there's the next thing that's wrong, the next thing that's wrong, the next thing that's wrong. Even after, because we eventually caved to the pressure, we eliminated the program. And even after that, the next state superintendent of public instruction, John Hoopenthal, still found the district out of compliance because there was a teacher teaching Rage Against the Machine. There was another one teaching KRS-One. Like he literally said, this teacher said, KRS-One says hip hop is an artistic response to oppression.
Right.
That was a violation of state law that he said that he in a finding of noncompliance. I mean, like,
what was the state law that eventually got passed? That was a big fight.
So it was called HB 2281, and it actually came three times. So the first time, it was actually a rider on a Homeland Security bill. Like, that's what they were trying to. Yeah, they were. Think about the political rhetoric around that. Thankfully, though, we had a centrist Democrat as governor for the first two times that it tried to pass, and so both times it was vetoed. But then, in the summer of 2010, was when Obama took Governor Napolitano to be his border czar. I forget what the exact name is, but and then the next in line was Jan Brewer. Hardcore, sort of a MAGA before MAGA type thing, more like the Tea Party Republican type, and she just ushered in a whole sweeping slew of racist legislation. And it was just coincidental that, you know, it just so happened to be in an election year in 2010, a midterm election. Right. You know, drive up the base. So that's when you saw the anti-immigrant SB 1070. You saw the state of Arizona eliminate affirmative action, and you saw the banning Mexican American studies go into effect.
A few things. One, Dr. Nolan Cabada, our guest, I'm concerned that a law was put into place.
Yes.
And I don't want to overlook that law because this compliance thing seems like something that can be scaled up. So do you think what happened in Arizona becomes a blueprint that people follow and then all of a sudden we have what you all were experiencing, because I didn't realize you completely had to get rid of the program.
So
that's problematic because it was an effective program, which we can talk about.
Exactly.
I didn't know the reach to that, because it seems like the game plan here is like, we're just going to pass a law, and maybe they're tinkering around to figure out how to pass a law. They already have this 1776 commission, which is basically saying, you know, we need to rewrite history. We need to show that America had good ideals. Sometimes it slipped and messed up, you know, the genocide of the Indians.
That's
a little thing like that. Slavery, you know, these were just slip ups. But the ideals is what drove us. And even when you dig deep into that, that's certainly far from the case. First of all, what do you think we need to be navigating right now based upon what happened in Tucson?
Got it. It's a twofold approach, but you're absolutely right that it is a blueprint that was created. So the step one, though, is about the is around the political rhetoric, is around sort of using the bully pulpit of your office. And what it requires is, number one, identifying something that is not well known, right? Like, and even if it's a common idea, it's not very well identified. So Mexican American studies, it's intentionally meant to be different, right? Actually, going back to Duncan Andrade, you know, he says that, you know, Einstein, I've never seen it properly attributed, but the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Right. And so Mexican American studies, ethnic studies in general, is meant to do things in a different way. And that's seen, but then when it's different, it can easily be twisted as threatening. And so what you start doing is you start, there's a massive political pushback right now by people like Chris Rufo and his whole crew. And what is that think tank? My brain is escaping me. I'm sorry. But anyway,
the Foundation?
I think it was the Manhattan Project, but it was, okay. but regardless, it's the same idea. You find something that you disagree with, but people don't know much about, and then you start creating meaning around that. So, you know, it was Mexican American studies, anti-white, anti-American, anti all this stuff. Same thing's happening with DEI right now. DEI is hating white people. DEI is making us feel guilty about the sins of the past. Ironically, being trumpeted by a white South African saying that there shouldn't be any collective guilt, but you know, we'll kind of avoid that for the second. So you have the political rhetoric component of it, but that gives license once you demonize and you say you basically created a problem, because remember, these are solutions in search of a problem, not a problem in search of a solution. So you create this problem and then you say, okay, I'm the only one who can solve this problem, right? And that's exactly what Tom Horn was doing. And I mean, if that sounds really familiar, right, from the, you know, the 45th administration, that's exactly what Tom Horn did. He's like, you know, I'm the only one who can solve this. Give me this power. Right. And so that's when the legislation comes in, and it's put in these very broad terms, right? That, you know, you can't, there shouldn't be feelings of guilt for who you are, and you, people need to be treated as individuals. And it's this really empty rhetoric. Because if you read any of the laws that are currently being passed right now, they're very broad, and they don't have really, what we found here was it's really hard to enforce the law that we had on the books here in Arizona, right? Because it's like, if you're driving down the street and it says speed limit 35, it's very clear, like, if you go over this, right? But how do you enforce something that says, like, well, this class was made for a specific racial ethnic group? It's like, it's so subjective. So a couple of big things is, one, there has to be alternative ways of framing this work. And unfortunately, we've been horrible at doing that. Because again, it's this very reactive framing. It's very right. much, you know, I just want to set the record straight on DEI. I want to set the record straight on critical race theory. It's like, that's not the point. You've already lost the framing war. And you hit the nail on the head at the beginning. You don't try to backtrack and be reactive. You got to be proactive and say, no, what you're doing right now is banning. You are book banning. You are censoring. You are actually infringing upon freedoms instead of enhancing freedoms. And, right. you know, and that's the core of the political rhetoric. The legal component takes a lot more. And I haven't seen as much of a cohesive strategy around that. But there are people who are doing that, who are challenging these laws in very important ways. Because again, it's sort of like, you know, that in the meantime, I mean, you're seeing universities in Florida getting gutted. You're seeing K-12 districts just being decimated because of alleged DEI work. And but I really appreciate it right now that the state of California just pushed back upon the Trump administration and said, you actually don't have the authority to dictate what our curriculum looks like in California. Right. And that's a broad overreach. And the problem is right now, people are so shell-shocked that they're like, how are we going to fight back? And it's like, no, you don't have time to sit there and be shell-shocked. We need to fight right now. And whether it's whether it's in public rhetoric, whether it's in the legal sphere. And we even had a lot of the grassroots movements going on around this work as well that was critically important at the same time. But all of them are really important. The problem right now, a big problem right now, is that sort of centrist liberals, they're afraid, and they don't know how to navigate any of this stuff. But they're right. so used to being in charge that they're not willing to give up their power, just listen and try to follow. Like, look, this is exactly what we have to be doing. And some of them, even because they're so inept at doing this work, they start adopting the rhetoric of the right. I mean, how many centrist liberals across the country, once the election happened, were like, okay, this is the end of woke. This is the end of, you know, we had the failed woke experiment and Kamala was too woke. It's like, there was nothing woke about her campaign. Like,
right.
you're afraid of this. So you use that to suit your narrative.
Well, there's a few things going on. We're talking with Dr. Nolan Cabana. He's the author or co-author of a book called Banned, talking about the elimination of Mexican-American studies. And it's something that I think people need to look at, especially at this point in time. A couple of things that you said. One, I'm glad you talked about this centrist attitude, right? There seems to be three battle lines that we have to deal with.
Exactly.
Battle line one is like, I don't care what's going on. I'm going to triple down on it. I'm gonna say I'm woke. I'm gonna say DEI, and we're gonna go fight we're gonna take the bull by the horns. Sounds good, but do you have the resources? Do you have do you have the means? Mm-hmm. Are you in a position to actually
exactly
fight fire with fire?
Exactly.
Right? Then you have folks that, as you described, the centrist folks who, you know, seem to go with the wind, right? You know, as you said earlier, just calm it down, take it down a notch, you know, that sort of thing. Let's moderate it. And then you have people that come from a point of sheer ignorance. And some of it is unintentional. A lot of it is intentional. And when I say that, meaning that I was very intentional about reaching out to you, somebody from Arizona who's in the middle of this fight, one, to build bridges, make sure people know that there are these other places to look at, and to have that type of conversation on this type of platform, so people can go, oh, okay, there were these other battles. Because what I find is you have a lot of people who feel like the wheel is just being invented. Like, you know, we having folks meeting and going, hey, we're going to have a battle around ethnic studies, and then they want to maybe replicate a bunch of stuff that you all did that didn't work, but they don't know because they never had these conversations.
Exactly.
So there are, you know, things that need to be, I think, kind of uplifted. But the common thread in many of these things is woeful ignorance in terms of different groups of people. So there are these major blind spots. And if we go back to what you're saying with the centrist folks, it's like, do you really even know what the curriculum was in Mexican American studies? You know, were they really telling people to overthrow the government? You know, is that what you believe was happening? Or, you know, was it a different type of approach where you made the education more relevant to the folks that were there? Two very, very different things, because as a good educator, you're supposed to make the lessons relevant, right?
Absolutely.
That's one. And then I'll come back and give you the floor again. The other thing, which I think you alluded to, is that this is not about Mexican-American studies in the first place. This is about subjugating a group of people and having them forever be in a underclass. And that to me is the fight. You know, this is not about ethnic studies. This is about, you know, you're actually finding a path to make, you know, your community not only smarter, but historically, if they're smarter in the academic sense, they become more competitive and actually will surpass you. And we don't want that. So, you know, whatever work you're doing, you know, it didn't even have to be Mexican-American studies. As you said, they would have found a way to get rid of you. Like, hey, you know, you have Aztec tattoo on your back. You can't teach in the class.
How'd you know I have that?
But you know what I'm saying? I mean, they would find something, you know?
I get you. And
I think if we understand that the name of the game is to disempower, then we take a different approach. Like, this is not about ethnic studies. This is about making sure that you never come up.
And I think just to add to that, because I think it's a both and, not an either or,
right,
that there is something threatening about the consistent underclass. Like, as long as we are janitors and farm workers and mechanics, and please don't get it twisted. I'm not trying to say there's anything wrong with those professions, because those are honorable people in my community. Right.
Right.
But when you're relegated to that, and that's your only option, that, you know, it, like you said, it relegates brown folk to a permanent underclass, which we see the same thing with black folks in different contexts, with, you know, and but we also need to be clear about it, that it is politically uplifting for the people who are doing the racial antagonism. So right. Tom Horn took that and took the banning and rode that to become state's attorney general. Okay.
Oh, I didn't know that. He went to become the attorney general.
Jesus Christ. Exactly. Which then he actually got caught in a hit and run, but that's a whole different thing. Right. That's just me being a chismoso. But then John Hoopenthal, who then implemented the law took his position as a state senator, and then took that to become the next state superintendent of public instruction. And this is, you want to be really clear about this. When he ran, he had a radio spot that said, and this is a verbatim quote, "If elected, I will stop La Raza."
What?
I swear to God, I swear to God. If you don't believe me, he was on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and she asked him about it direct. I almost drove off the road with it because, like, let's break that down real quick. Like, if he had said, if elected, I'm going to stop the black people or I'm going to stop Jewish people, that's automatic disqualification. But the brown scare in Arizona, especially in 2010, was so dramatic, right?
Right.
That he could ride that kind of xenophobia and racism to the next thing. And so it's not just about it's both political opportunism because it raises them up,
right,
and it keeps us from realizing our potential. And that potential was huge because, like I said, I alluded to before, I ran the stats in the program. And these are like high level inferential statistics that you are controlling for multiple hypotheses all at the same time, and consistently taking Mexican-American studies classes, in particular two Mexican-American studies classes, so you have a sort of a full year of this engagement, led to significant increases in graduation and passing the state standardized tests, including math tests, even right, though there's no Chicano studies math.
Right. But again, it's about making the education relevant.
Exactly.
You know? And if I can learn math by... Yes. You know, talking about how many apples I picked, that may be one way. Or I could learn math by talking about, you know, how many rhymes KRS-One said in 8 bars, right?
Exactly, exactly.
And people will perk up and be like, man, let me do that, because I think it comes down to we all learn. You know, my kids can sit there and tell you all kind of stuff about a video game. And it's our job as parents to be like, okay, let's take that into the next level. You know,
exactly.
Let's use video games as your learning platform.
There it is.
And that's going to be relevant. But somebody comes along and says, these kids are starting to get too smart. Let's ban video games and say this is the problem.
Exactly.
Then you're taking away a powerful tool that makes learning attractive.
Exactly. And it loops all the way back to what Duncan Andrade said. Never seen a child with an adverse relationship to learning.
Learning, yeah.
But definitely seen multiple ones with an adverse relationship to school, and you just hit the nail on the head.
Right. The brown scare, by the way, we're talking about a little bit about your book, Banned. That's one of the chapters, the second chapter in the book.
Yes.
We can break this down.
Yeah.
Let's talk about chapter 3. They tried to bury us, but they forgot we were seeds. That's an old... You
yes.
know, an old, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to say cliche, an old proverb.
Well, no, it's a parable.
Parable.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about the resistance to that.
Absolutely. So, you know, and I think that's where, you know, I love the way that Paulo Freire, the Brazilian critical theorist, talked about hope as an ontological need. Because you got to remember, like, we were kind of in a hopeless state for a second, because you have literally all the resources of a state coming down upon you, you know, mm-hmm. and that can be terrifying. I mean, I had ended up getting just for my statistical work, I ended up getting 4 subpoenas from the Attorney General's office as an assistant professor. So I don't have tenure. I'm just, you know, doing all this stuff. And that's minor compared to the amount of hatred. Because I like the way that Ibram X. Kendi flipped one of our ideas on its head in Stamped, where he said, it's not so much that racist ideas give rise to racist laws. It's sort of the mental model that we have, you know, it's that racist laws give rise to racist thought. We actually have it inverted, because what happens is once you pass a racist law, you have to justify it. And racism necessarily means you're justifying the unjustifiable. You have to create, you have to do all sorts of, you know, judo flips and all this, you know, matrix style avoidance to say, oh yeah, by the way, Black and Indigenous people are less than, and therefore they deserve to be treated as enslaved people, or they're not good stewards of the land, so we need to take over in this patronizing way, right? It all starts from a racist idea, but you have the policy and then the ideas come forth. But the problem is, once you're the target of that, the threats on physical safety are incredible. They go through the roof. And the number of times that all of us who were immersed in this were attacked, and I don't mean just like, you know, some, you know, keyboard activists. I'm talking like very direct in your face. It was a lot, but through that, what happened was that because there was a national connection to this work, and there was also a very tight knit community in Tucson, folks realized that this is a fight that we need to engage in. And so we didn't know how it was going to, what was going to work, but you had all these different constituencies. So you had the teachers who immediately filed a lawsuit against the state saying, this is blatantly unconstitutional. You had students who were organizing amongst themselves to say, like, no, this, like, if you're going to be talking about our education, you should have a student voice at the table, and you should be listening to us, both the state as well as the school district, because neither one, they all kind of took a father knows best approach. And then at the same time, there was this collective nationally. Well, one of the big ones, and I really need to keep a consistent shout out, was that Lalo Alcaraz, the cartoonist,
I know Lalo.
That's the dude who did the cover of the book. Like, that's his image that he made for the, and so, you know, he would do these artistic constructions, and then that would keep the spotlight on a national scale on Arizona. And so we had this hodgepodge. It didn't feel as tight knit as it was, because, you know, you're fighting the state and what's become known as state sponsored racism. But you had this loosely knit collective of folk who were all invested in making sure that Mexican American studies persisted and thrived, because it was so important to the community. You had the group also Motley coming out and doing benefit concerts. I totally fanboyed out. I got to interview one of the members of Also Motley. I mean, I've been watching you for 20 years. Now I get to interview you. That was kind of cool. But the point being that you have, you know, the resistance that had, in the same way that it took a lot of people to sort of manufacture the Brown Scare and the false outrage around Mexican American studies, it took an equally committed group of people to disrupt it along these different lines, whether it was grassroots activists, educators. You know, we had professional organizations, librarians, American Educational Research Association, National Association of Chicano Studies, all coming together and saying, look, the stakes are so high in this case. And so we had this collective that was constantly resisting. And that was the big thing, is that, you know, you don't want to have just, you know, one tool in your toolbox. You want to have multiple ones. And that's really what we were able to do.
Do you feel the current fight has similar firepower in terms of resistance? Do you see that sort of strength in numbers type of organizing, or do you see a lot of reactionary type of, formations?
Absolutely. I think it's sort of a both and. I think we are on a different scale, having it on a national level instead of a state level.
Well, not to cut you off, there obviously the looming of a national fight, but you know, we have about 5 years of seeing, they do this in Texas, they did this in Kentucky, they did this obviously in Florida, and what you're describing. And again, that just might be because we have to bridge these gaps. Absolutely. I haven't seen that sort of response like we saw in Arizona, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because you all are next door and we know people in Tucson and all that. And so we can kind of hear those stories. But from somebody who's been in those fights, are you looking and saying, hey, what they're doing in Florida, spot on with their resistance. What they're doing in Texas, spot on. I haven't seen that. In those places, and it's almost like, wow, are people even fighting back?
No, folks are fighting back, I will say that, but I don't think it's as concentrated, in the sense that there were a couple of differences that are instructive here. That's that a lot of folks who are responding to stuff that happens outside, like in the states that you just described, there's a tendency for them to be somewhat siloed. And the difference being that the ethnic studies program in Tucson, it had departmental status. It was, it served several hundred students. And also, and we had national connections. Like, people were trumpeting the successes of the program well before it came under attack.
Right.
And so it had kind of this people were flocking to it for those reasons. So it was easy for people to, on a national level, to say, oh, we need to support this. And then at the same time, Tucson is a very unique place, because even though in the greater Tucson area, there's roughly a million people, it's called the Old Pueblo for a reason. It feels very small, like small towns, right. You know, and everybody knows each other. You don't go to the supermarket without being like, okay, you know, you right. know, hey, Ms. Garcia, you know, something like that. And so, whereas like when I was in LA, I could go weeks without seeing somebody who I knew, you know, just in passing. And right. so, and actually the same thing when I lived in the Bay. And so when you have those deep connections, it's a lot easier to call on folk really quickly. Because there's a stronger connection. It also allows people to get on each other's nerves, but that's a different issue altogether.
Right.
But the point being that there was a unique historical point, but that also provides an opportunity. So if you're feeling siloed, if you're in Kentucky, for example, and you're feeling siloed, that means you need to be connected to other people who are doing ethnic studies work, DEI work, et cetera, and make sure that you have those strong connections. Right now, it is very reactive, because those we had those connections in place. And they're not necessarily there as much in these other areas, but you can still build them and still right. create resistance in that process. Well,
Dr. Nolan Cabetta, within this larger brown community, mm-hmm. did you run up against any sort of ideological divides? Were there a conservative element of brown folks that said, we don't need this? Were there mm-hmm. an assimilationist type of element that said, we need to, you know, leave all this cultural stuff alone and learn how mm-hmm. to become more American? Did mm-hmm. that become a wedge or a problem or something mm-hmm. that would show up at the polls, for example, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. would allow a horn to become
yeah.
attorney general or superintendent? Mm-hmm. So how do we deal with the internal type of divides?
Absolutely. Okay, so you hit the nail right on the head, because what's fascinating about Tom Horn is, in his political rhetoric, is that he always would say, he had this way of saying, you know, when I was 18 and I marched with Dr. King
on the mall,
I swear to God, it's like he has no evidence to support it, right? He doesn't have a picture. You know, again, he's an 18-year-old Canadian kid going into, I think he was going to Harvard at the time or something. But yeah,
right.
It's like, you're so full of it. And so he says, you know, his rhetoric around the content of our character, not the color of our skin, is a guiding force in my life as I fight racism at every step of the way, and then uses it to attack brown folk. Like that's the rhetoric that he engages in. But here's the interesting part that gets to your underlying issue. As he was navigating the politics of trying to pass 2281, he got a state representative who was a Central American migrant to be sort of the lead sponsor on the bill. And so he says, you know, we need to be colorblind, until he says, but look, a brown guy is sponsoring my bill. So he's colorblind until he's not. He's race evasive until he's not, right? And he did the exact same thing when they were creating the Brown Scare, because one of the lead quote unquote whistleblowers, he was a teacher of record in the district, and he didn't like the Mexican American Studies program because he was very much along the lines of what you're saying. He's an assimilationist, you know, America, 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 great, 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 great type of person. And he wasn't happy with, you know, brown students basically telling him that he needed to stop being so racist against them. And he got pissed off and cussed in class, slammed the book down, walked out. And then he reported what he saw in the Mexican American Studies program. Yeah, exactly. To the, God, what the heck is that guy's name? Is it Brown?
Well, you know, as you're talking, it reminds me of a tactic that is often used, and it kind of predates what happened in Tucson, but it goes back to the Prop 209 here in
yes.
California.
Yes.
So people forget the main architects of Prop 209, the anti-affirmative action bill, with Tom Woods and Glenn Custard, right? These were two white guys. I remember having them on our show.
Yeah.
And Jesse Jackson came on and lit them up, right? And
yes.
He said, and Jesse goes, they're going to find a black guy, you mm-hmm. know.
Exactly.
They're going to find a black face for this. And sure enough, they found that black guy in the form of Oh gosh, he became the face of this. Now I'm forgetting his name.
Ward Connerly.
Ward Connolly, yeah.
Yeah,
So
yeah, yeah.
Ward went around and was glad to be that blackface against affirmative action. And
Exactly.
it was just crazy. And so it sounds like, we find somebody, a conservative element in the
Yeah.
community, or we
Yep.
find a conservative
He's,
individual,
yep.
you elevate them. And
Exactly.
if they can culturally
Yeah.
signify, so
Absolutely. It's the same thing.
Ward Connolly couldn't culturally signify. Remember, there was a bunch of black preachers that surrounded him, and it's like, yo,
Of
Ward,
course.
we tried to get a hold of you, and he was so awkward, and it's like, I'm not around it. But they refine that now because they find people that's like, I'm from the hood, I'm from the street,
They
I'm.
always you find, and that's it. So the guy's name is John Ward, but he's Latino.
Oh, gosh,
And
you're
so
kidding.
I swear to God, and he was the one who was the whistleblower. But again, you find, and again, we have to be colorblind according to Tom Horne until you're not. So then when
Right.
Tom Horne writes about John Ward, he says John Ward, who happens to be Hispanic, like he literally highlights that in his public rhetoric. But you're right, because it's discursively a way of saying no. It's the same way that Trump goes, hey, there's my African American, the
Right.
Hispanics love me and all this stuff. And it's like, no, that's a load of crap. It's a tried and true way of doing this. And when you had the banning of affirmative action, when you had the banning of bilingual education, what's the first thing they do? They bring brown children into the space and say, we want to learn English. We need to learn English to be prosperous. And it's like, yeah, no one debates that. But when you have people who are attacking it under really bad pretenses and really bad research, you can just basically justify anything. And unfortunately, you have people of color at the front with the white folks pulling the strings at the back. And actually, that's what happened with the Harvard case that eventually eliminated affirmative action, was that the lead attacker, God, what the heck is his name?
Blumenthal, you're talking about Ed Blum?
Yeah, Ed Blum.
Yeah,
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
then
yeah, yeah.
he brought all
He
the
said
Asian folks
he brought
in.
all the Asians in to say, no, it's, see, I'm not racist. He played his cards too many times finding white women to be the representatives of his cause. Instead, he said, he came around and said, no, it needs to be Asian Americans there. It will insulate us from this.
Right.
And then selectively, he was able to say, see, Asians don't like affirmative action, when in fact, that's actually the minority of folks when you look at public opinion polls, but it's a selective way of doing it. It's
And
politically highly effective.
now they're suing because their numbers went down.
Exactly. And it's like, yeah, but
But
again,
because
they,
of that divide, you now have people that saying, "Well, I'm going to sip my coffee and let them fall on their face for, because what drove the whole thing was anti-blackness, or anti-immigrant, and those are the things." As we kind of wrap up, a couple of things at this moment, Dr. Nolan, Dr. C, what do you want us to do? Aside from pick up your book and tell them about the book.
So yeah, so banned the fight for Mexican American studies in the streets and the courts, 2025, Cambridge University Press by Nolan Cabrera and Robert S. Chang, the sociopolitical history of the banning of Mexican American studies, the resistance and all that. So now I can get my publisher off my back. Okay, good.
Right.
But I'd say a couple of things. We need to realize historically that if you go back to the culture wars of the 90s, the 2000s, 2010s, which is where my book picks up, in the 2010s, there is not a negotiation that can be had. This is a fight that we are in right now. We didn't create it. We didn't say, oh yeah, it's not like it's not like you go down to your gym, you're like, I would like to sign up for three rounds of sparring with so and so. This is like, no, you're thrown into the ring and sitting there and just trying to cover up. It's not going to do any good.
Right.
And unfortunately, I need our good centrist liberal, largely white folk who are afraid of the fight to step up and actually be involved in meaningful ways. I watch Bill Maher on a regular basis because he's kind of emblematic of this centrist liberal. I also like having high blood pressure because he drives me up a wall.
Right.
But the when you w watch these guys, they're always like, well, I'm not going to catastrophize the Trump administration. There was a New York Democrat on The Daily Show a couple of days ago who was saying, no, we need to work with Republicans to get stuff done. And And I'm like, you are so stupid naive. Like, are you really kidding me on that? Well, you know, it's for the betterment of the American people. Yeah, you're going to do things that will improve Americans' lives. And at the same time, then the MAGA crew and Trump in particular are going to take full credit for everything that you do. And unfortunately, as you abide, you normalize a fascist. And we can't stop saying that. Like, this guy does not care about the rule of law. You have a 34 times over felon convicted of sexual assault, who is also, you know, who's actually not a good businessman. I mean, the dude bankrupted a casino. The house always wins and you bankrupted a casino. Like, that's just no. And so we got to take all the rhetoric out and just understand the existential threat that he poses. That's even above someone like a George W. Bush, which I couldn't stand the Bush administration. But at the, you know, and I also don't like the Biden administration, but that's a different issue altogether. But right now, the fight is on. And I hope that folks will remember the words of Dr. King when he wrote his letter from a Birmingham jail, that he said, I have come to the regrettable conclusion that my primary fight is not necessarily with the overt Southern racists, but it's with the centrists, the centrist black preachers, the centrist white liberal who prefers social tranquility over social justice. Yeah. And that's where the primary stumbling block is. And for some reason, even with that less than 60 years ago, centrist liberals continue to think that in some way the left actually poses a greater existential threat to them than the right. When in fact, the right, look at the devastation and destruction along any lines, whether it's DEI, women's reproductive health, climate change, along anything, they're fundamentally destructive and they don't have a policy directive. It's just give me as much money and power as possible. Wow. That is scary. And we need to understand you cannot negotiate with that. You can only fight with it. And that's where we're at this particular point in time. Because again, the centrist liberals in Tucson kept trying to say, well, maybe if you know, it's fight time, you know, and don't sit here and armchair quarterback it and say, well, you know what you really should have done. If you're not in the fight, you don't get to talk about it. You either put up or shut up. So that's it.
Right. Because again, it wasn't really about Mexican American studies. It was about making sure brown folks never get in any sort of competitive position, academically speaking.
Exactly.
You know, keep the population dumb and, you know, dumbed down. And in theory,
yes,
I can control them.
Exactly.
Dr. Nolan Cabrera, thank you so much for joining us. How do we get a hold of you?
So, oh man, I screwed up with all my handles on social media, but I have ChicanoStocracy.com or at ChicanoStocracy on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Before folks at me, it's meant to imply there are some of us brown folk who have been able to succeed in certain elevated positions and asking what's the social responsibility that accompanies it. Not, well, we're the aristocracy of the brown folk, which everyone thinks. Right. Like, but yeah, so at Chicanostocracy, Chicanostocracy.com is the way to get in touch with me.
Okay. Hard Knock Radio. We're out for now. Peace.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan, Cam. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Woo.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah!
Bellevue! Come on!
Check out! Why every novice think they hard knock?